For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site. It is June the 16th, and we are in Baal Oscha. We're on page 782, and we're up to Pasuk Yod Aleph, bottom of the page.
We found it very interesting that Rabbi Feldman and Rabbi Franz spoke about the trumpets.
Yes. Now, it doesn't hurt that this week's parsha is Baal Oscha.
Right. So. Yeah.
Okay.
It works.
Okay. Vahi Bashana Hashenis, and it was in the second year, Bachodesh Hasheni, in the second month, Be'esrim Bachodesh, the 20th of the month, Na'ala he'anon me'al mishkan ha'idus, the cloud rose from upon the Mishkan. This is the 20th of the month of Iyar. We know that it's the second year after we left Mitzrayim. We left Mitzrayim in Nisan, and we left, of course, on the 15th of Nisan, and we arrived at Har Sinai on Rosh Chodesh Sivan of the third month. That's when we got to Har Sinai. We were at Har Sinai longer than was expected because we did the Avera of the Egel Hazav, the golden calf. And therefore, it took longer for us to get the Torah than was originally planned. It should have only taken 40 days. Moshe Rabbeinu came down from Har Sinai on Shiva Asar B'Tammuz, the 17th of Tammuz of that year, the summertime. Had things gone as planned, it seems, we don't know this for certain, but it seems that we would have then gone to Eretz Yisrael from Har Sinai. We would have left Eretz Yisrael. But that's not what happened. Instead, we did the Avera of the Egel Hazav. We were delayed because then Moshe Rabbeinu had to go back up the mountain for an additional 40 days in order to beg forgiveness for us. And then he had to go up again for a third set of 40 days in order to receive the second set of luchos, and he came down on Yom Kippur. So now we've gone from the summertime all the way into the fall, and it's Yom Kippur. And then on the day after Yom Kippur, Hashem commanded that we donate materials for the Mishkan, which Rashi explains was a tikkun, it was a way of correcting the Avera of the golden calf, was the Mishkan. It seems that the Mishkan might not have been commanded had we not done the Avera of the golden calf. But we did. And so, therefore, we then spent the winter time both donating and constructing the Mishkan. The Mishkan was put up for the first time after a week long of practice or training. Then on Rosh Chodesh Nisan, we're now in the second year, back in the springtime of the second year, that was the first day the Mishkan was put up, and the work of the Mishkan was set in motion. We then came to the second Pesach, after we left Mitzrayim, which we spoke about earlier in Parashas Balosa, and we observed the second Pesach. We then came to Pesach Sheni of that year, which was in Iyar. And then, a few days later, on the 20th of Iyar, Hashem finally has us travel from Har Sinai. So we've been at Har Sinai now for nearly a year. We got to Har Sinai in Rosh Chodesh Sivan, and we leave on the 20th of Iyar. That's 10 days before Rosh Chodesh Sivan. So it's an entire year minus 10 days. That's how long we've been at Har Sinai. And now we leave, and the goal is to go directly to Eretz Yisrael. Now, we're going to get delayed on our way to Eretz Yisrael by several things which we're going to learn about here in Parashas Baal Oscha, not tonight, but we will learn about several things that will delay us. They are things that we do wrong as we travel from Har Sinai to Eretz Yisrael. We get a little bit delayed into the summertime. We're already, the 20th of year is already approaching the summer, and then we get delayed even further, and we end up getting to Eretz Yisrael in the middle of the summertime, and then of course we do that ultimate avera of sending the spies and our reaction to the spies, and then we get delayed for the next 38 years. But even before we get delayed with the avera of the meraglim, of the spies, we're delayed anyway because of events that are going to take place at the end of Parshas Balosra, which we'll learn about as we move on here. But when we leave Har Sinai on the 20th of Iyar, the goal is to head straight to Eretz Yisrael. Again, had we not done the avera of the Egel Hazav, this might have happened a lot earlier. But because of the Egel Hazav, certainly we were delayed until now, but the goal is to get there very quickly. And we'll see that we're going to get delayed. But at this point, the Klal Yisrael doesn't know they're going to get delayed as we leave Har Sinai. The cloud rising, as we learned before, was the symbol that it is time to travel. So the Pasuk says, Pasuk Yud Beis, verse 12, Vayisu v'nei Yisrael l'masehem mimi bar Sinai. The Jews traveled according to their travels from the wilderness of Sinai. Vayishkon he'anan b'mivar paran. And this first leg of the journey, the cloud dwelled in the wilderness of Paran. So it went from Sinai to Paran. Vayisu barishana. They traveled initially. Api Hashem b'yad Moshe. By the word of Hashem in the hands of Moshe. Vayisa dego machane v'nei Yehuda v'rishana l'tzivosam, and the flag of the camp of Yehuda traveled first according to their hosts. Ve'al tzvao, and who was in charge of the hosts of Yehuda? Nachshon ben Aminadav. He's the one, he's the Nasi, he's the prince of Yehuda, and therefore he is the one in charge of this particular machane, this particular camp. Each camp, of course, has three tribes. So, Ve'al Tzva Ma'atei B'nei Yisachar, and then in addition to Yehuda, you have in charge of the hosts of the tribe of Yisachar is Nisanel ben Tzuar. And Ve'al Tzva Ma'atei B'nei Zvulun, and on the, I keep saying the hosts, how they translate it here, they say legion. The legion, okay, same thing, of the tribe of Zvulun was Eliyav ben Chilon. V'hurad HaMishkan, the Mishkan was dismantled. V'nasu v'nei Gershonu v'nei Merarino se'a Mishkan. So at this point, after the first of the camps travels, which is Yehuda's camp, then travels the two of the three branches of the Levim, that's Gershon and Merari, who were carrying the materials of the Mishkan. Of course, they were not carrying the utensils of the Mishkan. They were carrying the boards and the curtains, etc., that were going to be used to construct the Mishkan when they got to the new place. So they traveled after the first camp. So then traveled the camp of Reuven. And now Reuven's leader is Elitzur ben Shedeur. And then you have the tribe of Shimon and his leader, Shlumiyah ben Sri Shaddai. And Eliyasaf ben Du'el leading the tribe of Gad. So that's the second camp. After the second camp, then traveled the Kahasim, that's the third branch of the Levium that had not traveled yet. So they traveled, they were the ones who carried the Mikdash. Mikdash here means the sanctified objects of the Mishkan. That would be the Aron, the Shulchan, the Menorah, the two Mizbechos, they carried them. Vehikimu es haMishkan ad Boam, and the first two groups of Levim, that's Gershon and Merari, who had traveled previously, they put up the Mishkan before the children of Kahas got there. So since Gershon and Merari had a head start over Kahas, by the time Kahas got to the new camp, the Mishkan was well underway in being constructed so that there would be a place to put the utensils that were being carried by the children of Kahas. Now comes the third camp. It's led by Ephraim. Elishama ben Amihud is the leader of Ephraim. Gamliel ben Pedot Sur, and comes Menashe at Tzugazunt, the leader being Gamliel ben Pedot Sur at Tzugazunt. Ve'al Tzvam Atev b'nei Binyamin, Abidan ben Gidoni, and then comes the leader, then Binyamin with its leader, Abidan ben Gidoni. Finally, the last camp, Ve'asad Degal Machaneh b'nei Dun, then comes the last camp of Dun, Me'aseif l'chola machanos, that which gathered all of the camps, they translate that as the rear guard of all the camps. Okay, that would say that is, I would say that is not an exact translation. That is a paraphrasing. Mi'aseif means that which gathers, that's what it means, of all the camps, according to their hosts. Ve'al tzava'o Achiezer ben Amishadai. So the leader was Achiezer ben Amishadai. Ve'al tzava'o Mate ben Asher, Pagiel ben Achron. Asher was with him, and that his leader was Pagiel ben Achron. Ve'al tzava'o Mate ben Naphtali, Achira ben Enan. And then comes Naphtali, the last of the camp, of the tribes, and his leader is Achira ben Enan. The reason why Dan is called Mi'aseif l'chol ha-machanos, that which gathers in all the camps. So the Rashi cites the Yerushalmi that says that because Dun had many people, Dun was the second largest tribe. The largest tribe was Yehuda, but the second largest tribe was Dun, so it was very large. So they traveled last, and anybody who lost anything, left things behind, the tribe of Dun would be scouring the camp to see if anybody left anything behind, and they would be able to return it later on. That's why it's called Me'aseif L'chol HaMachanos, that which gathered all of the camps. Eile Ma'aseh B'nei Yisrael Tzivosam, these are the travelings of the B'nei Yisrael according to their hosts. Vayiso, and they traveled. This is meant to be a snapshot of how they traveled always. This is the first time they traveled, but this is the way they would travel from here on in. Whenever they travel, this is the method they would use for their traveling. Again, at this time, they don't realize it's going to be for the next 38 years, but that right now, but we know in retrospect that is what ends up happening. It is noteworthy that we set up a system that in traveling, we have the final camp being one that gathers lost objects. It is everybody knows this. It takes a common experience for all of humanity that when you travel, you forget things. Mm-hmm. Happens to everybody. Always leaving things behind. Who has not experienced that feeling? You're already on the road, whether you're in the car and you're already a good long distance out of the city where you're traveling from, or you're already at the airport or whatever it is, and you say, "Oh, I left behind," or "Did I bring along? Did I bring that? Did I put it in my suitcase?" Right? Very, very common thing. Everybody leaves things behind when they travel. It is a common thing. It is a human experience because when you travel, you're by definition out of sorts. Baderech, when you're on the road, that's why Amalek attacked us when we were on the road, because when a person travels, they are always more vulnerable, less settled, less organized. And therefore, it is not a disorganized person who leaves things behind when they travel. It is a normal person who leaves things behind when they travel. It is the abnormal, super organized person who does not leave things behind when they travel. That's the exception to the rule. That's not the rule. And therefore, when Klal Yisrael would travel, Dun would be in the rear of the traveling group in order to collect that which was lost, and then they would be able to return it. Now, it is also worthwhile to note that returning a lost object, as much as we culturally here in the United States, culturally, it is the accepted thing that when you find something that does not belong to you, that you seek out its owner. The cultural way this is done does not line up perfectly with the halacha of Hashavas Aveda. There are some differences, but there's no question that culturally in the United States, when you see an object that on the street or in the office or or on your property and it does not belong to you, you try to find out, well, who does it belong to? And the mantra of finders, keepers, losers, weepers is not really culturally the acceptable way people behave in the United States. I'm talking about everybody, not just Jews, but everybody, that typically people find things and they attempt to find the owner. That's a typical thing. That is primarily a result of affluence, because when people have much and they're not lacking, so then, as Rashi says in Parshas Miketz, in describing the 7 years of plenty, it's Ayin Tova, that everybody has a good eye, a generous eye for each other. People are more generous with each other when there is a lot to go around. In a culture where, God forbid, things are more tight financially, economically, then this the people's behavior towards lost objects would certainly shift towards simply keeping what they find. The Torah, the default in the Torah is, believe it or not, that if someone loses something, then they've lost it. And if you find it, it's yours. That's the default. That's the starting point. The Torah then says a chiddush, the Torah says a novelty, that if you discover an object that was lost by a fellow Jew, then you are required to return it, provided that there is a way to properly identify the original owner. We've talked about this before when we learned about Hashavas Aveda back in Parashas Mishpatim. The halacha is you're not allowed to return an object that you cannot properly identify the owner. Meaning, if I find an object that does not have any
identification.
No, I'm sorry. That has identification. I find an object that has identification. So it's got, I find a piece of jewelry, and it has a nick on it, which could be identified, or it has an engraving on it that could be identified. And then someone says they lost a piece of jewelry. I'm not allowed to give it back to them without them identifying it. Why am I not allowed to give it back? What's wrong? Someone says, I lost my necklace, and I found the necklace. I'm at a wedding, and there's a necklace on the dance floor after the dancing is over. So I pick it up and I take it to the band and I say, I found the necklace. The band announces, anybody lost the necklace, come forward. A woman comes forward and says, I lost the necklace. They hand her the necklace. You're not allowed to do that. Why are you not allowed to do that?
It might not be hers.
It might belong to somebody else. Just because she claims that she lost the necklace doesn't mean that it's her necklace. Maybe somebody else's necklace. You think you're doing a nice thing, mm-hmm. but you might be taking away from somebody else. Now, if there's no way of identifying whose it is, if there's no simon, you can't identify who it is. No one can. It's a generic piece of jewelry. Anybody could have it. Then you're allowed to keep it. Then it's yours. In which case, if someone comes forward and says, I lost the necklace, if you want to give it to them, give it to eight. You can give it to whoever you want. You can give it to your daughter. You can give it to your mother. You can give it whoever you want. It's yours. You can pawn it if you want. It belongs to you. So if someone says, I lost the necklace, and you want to give it to them, fine. Do whatever you want. It's yours. But if it has a simon, you're not allowed to just give it to whoever claims it without them giving you the identifying piece of information to prove that it belongs to them, so that you know that you're not giving it to the wrong person. And even if the person seems very trustworthy, they genuinely lost the necklace, maybe two people lost the necklace. How do you know she's the only one who lost the necklace? Maybe there's other people who lost the necklace. And therefore, you have to make sure they can prove that it is theirs through telling you a simon, a way of identifying the piece of jewelry. But that is with a fellow Jew. With a fellow Jew, we are required to return an object that has an identifying factor, an identifying piece of information there. If it is an object that was lost, not by a fellow Jew, then there is no requirement to return it. Then the rule is finders, keepers, losers, weepers, which the Torah assumes is the rule in the whole world. And that we Jews are the ones who return lost objects. But losing an object and giving up hope of finding it is a way of essentially relinquishing ownership. And someone else who finds it gets to keep it. In fact, what do you think is the rule about this? You're walking on La Vista Road and you find a $20 bill. Now, money is by definition impossible to identify. Because even if you write your name on the dollar bill, which is probably illegal, but even if you do that, it doesn't prove it's yours because money is exchanged. So just because you wrote your name, I wrote my name on the $20 bill, who says I didn't spend it? And someone else has the $20 bill. So then my name doesn't prove it's mine. Even if I tell you the serial number of the money, so what? That just proves I've seen the dollar, that money. Okay, maybe I had it last week, but since then I spent it. So it doesn't prove it's mine. So money, by definition, is non-identifiable. Therefore, by definition, if you find money, you can keep it. Even if you know that a Jew lost it, you can keep it if you find money. You don't have to put it in tzedakah. People say, oh, just put it in tzedakah. If you want to put it in tzedakah, that's fine if you wish, but you're not required to. It is your money. If you find the $20 bill on Livingston Road, it is yours. Do you have to give miser? Do you have to take 10%? Take $2 off the $20 and put it in tzedakah. Is that $20 income?
No.
The halacha is, it is income.
It is income.
It is income. Hashem gave you $20. What's the difference whether you worked for that $20 or you found the $20? Hashem gave you $20. And therefore, it is income. And therefore, if you are in the bracket of income that you normally give miser, then you're required to give miser from that $20. People don't think that way because they think, well, it's a lost object. It's not income. No. The default is if you find something, it's a gift from Hashem to you. It's yours. The novelty is in the Torah that if it was a fellow Jew who lost it and there's a way of identifying the owner, then you are required to return it. But that is a chiddush. That is a novelty that the Torah says. When we travel, I'll get back to your question in a minute, but when we traveled, we set up a system to provide returning of lost objects, where this large tribe of Dun would travel in the back of the group to pick up lost objects and return them, which was a uniquely Jewish thing to do. It is laudable that in our culture, it is the accepted thing to do almost universally in our culture that people return lost objects. That's a beautiful thing. That's a good thing. But they learned that from us. That was not the way the world worked. That was learned from us. And I am also suggesting to you that it is only because we live, Baruch Hashem, in an affluent society. In a non-affluent society, you don't find such benevolence when people find lost objects. But they did set it up in the Midbar that Dun would return lost objects that were discovered.
So, Rabbi Pransky, I'm just wondering if there's a limiting time factor on Maser, because in the 1960s, we went to a World's Fair in New York, yeah. And while we're waiting in line, I see a $10 bill and a $5 bill on the ground. So I picked it up, and instinctively, automatically, I just said, did anybody lose $15? And so Alan said, anybody can claim it.
Right. Anybody can claim it.
So the thing is, so we ended up keeping it.
Mm-hmm.
So is there a time limit?
So,
on Maser? Should I?
it's a very good question. So the answer is there's no time limit on Maser. However, the Maser for $15 is $1.50. Right? So we assume that sometime between the 1960s and today, in your giving tzedakah, you probably gave at least $1.50 more than Maser over those years. And therefore, it was included in other tzedakah that you've given since then, and therefore you do not need to go give specifically $1.50 for that $15. Right. That's usually what we assume in lower amounts of Maisa. Then it gets it's what is called Muvla. It is swallowed up by all the other tzedakah that we give. It was included. You don't have to worry about it. That question will only come up if it was a really significant sum. Then the Maisa would have been a lot of money. So, and you're not really sure whether over time you've given that amount of extra tzedakah. That would be something to ask your LOR what to do about that.
Thank you. Does that qualify for like a Baal Tshuva who didn't give Meiser?
Meiser is a halacha that one has to begin doing before they're absolutely required to do it. It's a proper thing to do. People should give Meiser, but if a person has not yet begun to do so, they don't have to go back and rework all of their, all the Meiser that would have happened over the years.
Okay.
So it's only from when one began, Baal Tshuva or not Baal Tshuva. It doesn't make a difference. Okay. From where one began, that would be where one calculates.
Yeah. What happened to the Erev Rav? Are they still hanging on, or did we
dump them? Erev Rav, a lot of them were killed in the Egel HaZahav, but even Rashi says in Yehoshua there were still some members of the Erev Rav there when we got to Eretz Yisrael. So I don't. The Erev Rav, they were. It's not one. They weren't a uniform group. Some were better, some were worse.
I always think of it as a tribe or something.
It's a lot of people. There were a lot of people. Rav means a lot. Erev mm-hmm. Rav. There were a lot of people there, and many of them were bad apples, and they definitely caused us a lot of trouble. But Rashi says in Yehoshua there were still some remaining when we got to Eretz Yisrael.
So how did they travel?
So you can ask that really anybody who didn't have a place, which would be any Ger.
Right.
Ger doesn't have a right. That's the whole story with Mikal, the one who cursed, because he didn't have a place. Mm-hmm. So they would travel wherever. They didn't have a specific place. So in the traveling, I don't think that any of the tribes begrudged anybody traveling with them. It was in camping that was more of a question of where they camped. But the traveling, they probably just went along wherever they felt comfortable. Okay, so here we have, again, a snapshot of the traveling. I do want to also make note of the fact that the Nesiim, that's the princes of each of the tribes, are mentioned here. And they have been mentioned over and over and over again. They were introduced in Parashas Bamidbar right in the beginning because they're the ones who helped Moshe Rabbeinu count the Jews. They were then mentioned again in when the Jews were divided up into various camps. And here they're mentioned again. They were also mentioned in Parashas Naso with the various karbanos that they brought. And each one was mentioned twice in those karbanos. So these names, these 12 names, are very, very familiar names. We, of course, the most familiar of those names is, of course, Nachshon ben Aminadav. That's the one everybody's familiar with because of jumping into the Yam Suf. Mm-hmm. But the truth is that these 12 names are repeated many times in the Chumash. We're going to find later on, at the end of the 40 years, there are going to be 12 leaders of the tribes who are going to be different than these 12. But they're only mentioned once in the Chumash, and therefore they're far less familiar than these names. These names people are much more familiar with because they are repeated many times in the Chumash. That's no accident that they're repeated so many times. Remember that these 12 are from the group of Shotrim, of the overseers in Egypt who were beaten because they refused to beat their fellow Jews. It was their responsibility to make the Jews fulfill their court of bricks, and then when they didn't do so, then they were beaten instead. And Hashem rewarded them by making them the leaders of the people because they took responsibility for the people in Egypt, so therefore they were made the leaders. 12 of them became the leaders of the tribes over here. Okay, Pasuk Chavtes, verse 29, we now return to one of the more famous characters in the Chumash, although he is not named by the name we had him back in Parshas Yisro. Vayomer Moshe lechovav ben Reuel hamidyani chosein Moshe. And Moshe said to Chovav, the son of Reuel, the Midyani, who was the father-in-law of Moshe. Moshe speaks to Chovav ben Reuel. The question is, who is Chovav ben Reuel? Well, doesn't the Torah identify him? It says he was from Midian, and it says he was the father-in-law of Moshe. Who was the father-in-law of Moshe? Was Chovav ben Reuel the father-in-law of Moshe? Or was Reuel the father-in-law of Moshe, and Chovav is the son of the father-in-law of Moshe? Which one is it?
He's a son.
Okay, so there are various ways of explaining it. Some say that Chovav is the father-in-law of Moshe. It's another name for Yisro. Yisro had seven names, and Chovav would be one of those names. Another explanation is no. Chovav is the son of Yisro, and Reuel is another name for Yisro. And yet another explanation says, and this is not an uncommon tool that we find particularly in Divrei Hayamim, both Chovav and Reuel are names for Yisro. He was not Chovav, the son of Reuel, but Yisro has two names that are mentioned here. Chovav and Reuel are both Yisro's names. You do find this in Divrei Hayamim, that sometimes the way that a person's name is mentioned is by being the son of that person or the daughter of that person, and it really means that person's name themselves. Rashi in Parashas Yisro first indicates that both Chovav and Reuel are names of Yisro, and then he says no, that I'm trying to remember what his other, I think he says that does he say that Chovav was the real name or Reuel was the name? One minute, please. Rashi says in Yisro, first he says Chovav is Yisro, and Reuel is also Yisro, and then some say Reuel was the father of Yisro. Right. Now, Reuel, now we've had the name Reuel before. We had before that the daughters, when they were chased away, when the daughters of Yisro were chased away by the shepherds, and Moshe Rabbeinu saved them, and then it says they came to Reuel, their father. Sounds like Reuel's Yisro. But some say Reuel there means the grandfather, because you call your grandfather your father. It's the same thing. So again, this is a little bit of a debate, exactly the names of Yisro, but we are going to take the approach that he is talking to Yisro. Chovav ben Reuel is Yisro. That's certainly the approach that Rashi uses over here, that Chovav ben Reuel is Yisro, and he's the one who Moshe is talking to. So, what does Moshe Rabbeinu say to Yisro? Nosim anachnu, we are traveling, el ha-makom asher amar Hashem, to the place that Hashem had said about that place, oso atein lachem. That is the place I'm giving to you. We're going to that land that Hashem has promised to us. Lecha itanu, go with us. Vehitavnu lach, we will do good for you. Ki Hashem diber tov al Yisrael, because Hashem has spoken good about Yisrael. Now, what does this mean? What does it mean, we will do good with you? For Hashem has spoken good about Yisrael. The word tov is used twice in this pasuk. You should go with us, meaning to Israel. Moshe Rabbeinu is asking Yisro to come along. Yisro didn't have to come along. Yisro came to the Jewish people, and even though he seems to have been Megayer, he seems to have converted to accept the laws of the Torah, but he did not get out of Egypt. He was not part of the people who came out of Egypt. He is not a son of Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. And therefore, it seems that he was not required to go along with the Jewish people to Israel. Moshe Rabbeinu is asking him to please come along, and if you do so, we will do good for you, for Hashem has spoken good about Yisrael. The implication is that the good that Moshe Rabbeinu is talking about, that we will do for you, Yisro, and the good that Hashem said about the Jewish people is the same good, because it's the same word, tov. So we'll do good for you because Hashem has spoken good for us. So if we assume that, let's take that for the moment, that Moshe Rabbeinu is saying we will do good for you because Hashem has spoken good about us. What does one thing have to do with the other? Why is it we will do good for you because Hashem has spoken good about us? So what's the difference that Hashem has spoken good about us? What does that have to do with doing good for Yisrael? Why should one thing impact the other? Why does the Moshe Rabbeinu just say, we will do good for you because we love you, because we want you, because you're good for us, so we'll do good for you? What does it matter that Hashem has spoken good about the Jewish people? What is that? Why is that an important factor in his trying to convince Yisro to come along?
That's why he Megayer.
Okay.
You heard good about things that Hashem did in Mitzrayim.
Okay. Okay, so that Hashem has done good for us would be a reason for you, Yisro, to continue with us. And after all, that's what attracted you to us in the first place.
And he accepts the Yom Mach HaShemayim, that so now he's going to be the benefit of all the goodness Hashem has bestowed on his people.
Okay.
Thinking he has family.
Okay.
His daughter and grandchildren.
Okay, so then it has nothing to do with Hashem doing good for us, right? It has to do with...
I think it does have. Hashem is good for Israel, and your daughter and your grandchildren are
Israel,
see.
Okay,
you know?
Okay. So, the first thing to understand is, what does it mean that we will do good for you?
We'll take care of you.
So that could be what it means. But Rashi tells us it means something more important than that, or I should say more specific than that. As we've mentioned, Gerim do not have a portion in the land of Israel. They can't have a portion in the land of Israel because they did not leave Egypt. And the land was only given to the tribes, not given to Gerim. It was not given to converts. So converts do not have a place in Israel. Now that's a very difficult way to live in Israel, because even if they buy land, remember, buying land is not a permanent sale. Land always goes back to the original owner in Yovel. So you're really only leasing the property. You're never able to call a land yours if you buy land from another person. It's only a temporary purchase. And the Gerim, therefore, never had a place that was their own. So that was a challenging thing, especially in an agricultural society where the land is everything. So Moshe Rabbeinu tells Yisro, we will do good for you. And Rashi tells us that Moshe Rabbeinu kept this promise, that they did good for Yisro. And that is that they gave land to the children of Yisro. That when they got to Eretz Yisrael, they found land to give to Yisro. Now we're going to read a little further before we discuss how that happened. But let's leave it right now as just, we will do good for you, because Hashem has spoken good about Yisrael. Let's just leave it at that for now. Let's keep reading. Pasuk Lamed, verse 30. Vayomer elav lo eilech. So Yisro says, I will not go. Ki im el artzi vel moladati eilech. I will go to my land and to my birthplace. That's where I'm going to go. That is where my possessions are. That is where my family is. It's true, I have a daughter here, but Yisro had other daughters as well, other family as well. And I'm going back to my place. So then Moshe Rabbeinu says further, Vayomer, don't leave us, please. For you know our encamping in the wilderness. And either they translate it as, you have been for us as eyes, or it means you will be for us as eyes. Meaning, what did he do? What does it mean you have been for us as eyes? You witnessed good, and also
you saw the judgment.
Okay, you saw the trouble. You saw what was going on with judgment. That there was, that everybody was lined up in front of me, in front of Moshe Rabbeinu, and you suggested having a hierarchy of judges, which we then incorporated. So you noticed something that helped us out, and in the future you can do the same thing for us. You can be a person who will notice things and make life better for us. Rashi also adds another explanation, which is, you will be for us as our eyes. Just as a person is very careful with their eyes, the eyes are very sensitive organs, and therefore a person is very careful not to let anything hurt their eyes, we will protect you, you will be precious to us like our eyes. And Moshe Rabbeinu continues, V'ha'yaki se'lechi imanu will be when you go with us, if you'll continue with us. V'ha'ya ha'tov ha'hu, and it will be that good, asheyeti v'Hashem imanu, that Hashem will do good for us, ve'itav nulach, we will do good for you. The word tov is mentioned in this pasuk three times. The good that if you come with us, then that good that Hashem does good for us, we will do good for you. It is here that Rashi says that they gave him land in Israel. So that means that the first time when Moshe Rabbeinu said, we will do good for you, it did not mean we will give you land in Israel. I jumped the gun a little bit in the last pasuk. There, the good meant something else. Here, good means the land. Moshe Rabbeinu is upping the ante. Before, he did not offer him land. But now he's saying, listen, come with us. You were so helpful. You will be helpful. We will cherish you. Come with us. And if you do, then the good that Hashem does good with us, we will then do good with you. So we will pass on that goodness to you. Here, the goodness means getting the land. Hashem is going to do good with us by giving us the land. We will pass on some of that goodness to you and give you some of the land as well. Now, before, when Moshe Rabbeinu said, we will do good with you, for Hashem has spoken good about the Jewish people, that word tov did not mean the land. It meant something else. This is now trying to up the ante to get him to stay. The Torah does not tell us what happened. It doesn't tell us. Instead, the Torah goes on to say, "Vayisu me'har Hashem derech shloshes yamim." They traveled from the mountain of Hashem a way of 3 days. "Va'aron bris Hashem nosea lifnehem," and the Ark of the Covenant of Hashem was traveling before them. "Derech shloshes yamim." A path, a way of 3 days. Lasur lahem minucha, to scout out for them a place to rest. Vanan Hashem alehem yomam, and the cloud of Hashem was upon them during the day. Binas am mina machane, when they traveled from the camp. So I only read those two to show you that the Torah does not conclude what happened between Moshe and Yisro. We know Moshe said, "Come with us." Yisro said, "No." Moshe said, "No, come with us." And the Torah doesn't say what the response was. These last two psukim that I just read now, we will blean out, or we will plan on reading them again when we start the next class, because that really leads into the next story, and we're going to talk about that. But right now, we're going to focus on Yisro and what happened. The Torah doesn't tell us what happened. Well, we know what happened, but we don't know it from here. We know what happened back in Parshas Yisro. If you hold the place here on page 786 and go back to page 390, well, 396 and 3, well, let's start at page 400. Page 400. Page 400 is the conclusion to that famous story of Yisro, where he sees that Moshe Rabbeinu is judging everybody, and he says this is not a good thing, and he suggests that there be a hierarchy of judges. And then it says at the top of this page, Vayishma Moshe lekol chosno, Moshe listened to the voice of his father-in-law, Vayas kol asher amar, he did everything that he said, and he incorporated the suggestion of having a hierarchy of judges. After the Torah describes the new system under Yisro, at the end of that paragraph in Pasuk Chaf Zayin, verse 27 on page 400, the Pasuk says, Vayishalach Moshe es chosno, and Moshe sent his father-in-law away, Vayelech lo el artso, and he went to his land. So we know that Yisro returned to Midian. The question is, when did he return to Midian? The Torah here does not tell us contextually when this story happens. You see, the Parashas Yisro begins with Yisro coming to the Jewish people. There is a machlokas in the Gemara. Did Yisro come before Matan Torah or after Matan Torah? Did he come before or after the Torah was given? We know he came to Har Sinai, because the Pasuk says he came to Har HaElokim. He came to the mountain of Hashem. That's where he met Moshe Rabbeinu. He brought Zipporah and Moshe's two sons, Gershom and Eliezer, and brought them to Moshe at the mountain. That's what it says explicitly earlier here in Parshas Yisro. So we know he came to Har Sinai. But when did he come to Har Sinai? Did he come to Har Sinai sometime between Rosh Chodesh Sivan and the 6th of Sivan when we got the Torah? Did he come during those 6 days? Or did he come after we got the Torah? That is a machlokas. But either way, when it says, and here if you'd like, you can look on page 396, when it says in Pasuk Yud Gimel, verse 13, Vayehi mimacharos, and it was the next day. This is when Yisro observes that Moshe Rabbeinu is sitting and judging everybody, and the Jews are standing up in line. And he says, this is not Derech Eretz, this is not appropriate. Everybody agrees this story happened after Matan Torah. He may have come before Matan Torah, he may have come after Matan Torah, but the story of the judges certainly happens after Matan Torah. Where does it happen? It happens at Har Sinai. That is clear that this takes place at Har Sinai, that he sees what is going on. At least, I shouldn't say that it is clear. I take that back. It never says that it happens at Har Sinai, but we presume it happened at Har Sinai. It certainly happened after the Torah was given. That's clear. So the Torah then describes, without giving us a clear date of when this happens, only that it happened after after the Torah was given, then he observes this problem, he makes the suggestion is incorporated, and then, back on page 400, as we already read, then it says, Moshe Rabbeinu sent away his father-in-law, and his father went back to his land. But it doesn't tell us when that happened. That could have happened immediately after the preceding story of the judges, of making the new system of judges, or it may have happened later. We don't know when it happened. Well, as Rashi tells us, we know Yisro was still there when we left Har Sinai. Because as we just read in Parshas Baaloscha on page 786, Moshe Rabbeinu has this conversation with his father-in-law that he'd like him to come with us to Eretz Yisrael. And as Rashi says, we never find that Yisro went back to Midian and then came back to Har Sinai a second time. We don't find that. And therefore, there we have, as is common in the Torah, a muktam u'muuchar ba'Torah, that there's no chronological order in the Torah. This pasuk on page 400, Pasuk Chav Zayin, verse 27, Vayeshalach Moshe Eschosno, Vayelech La'aretzo, Moshe Rabbeinu sent away his father-in-law and he went to his land. That pasuk occurs after this conversation here in Parshas Baaloscha. We don't know exactly when after the conversation, but at some point after this conversation, when Moshe Rabbeinu says to Yisro, come with us, we'll do good for you. And Yisro says, no. And Moshe Rabbeinu says, no, come with us, we'll do good for you. At some point following that conversation, Moshe Rabbeinu sent away his father-in-law, and his father-in-law returned to his land. So Yisro did not accompany the Jews into Eretz Yisrael. But the thing is, we still don't know exactly when this happened. Meaning, it's possible that Yisro, immediately leaving Har Sinai, did not travel with the Jewish people to Israel, and instead went to Midian, went back to his land. It is also possible that just as this pasuk on page 400 is really not in chronologically the right place, it really goes after the conversation here on page 786, well, it may also go later than that. Meaning, it could be that he did listen to Moshe Rabbeinu and go with the Jewish people towards Eretz Yisrael, and then at some point later, after perhaps the story of the spies, when we were now going to wander for the next 38 years, it could be that's when he returned to his land. After all, it says Moshe Rabbeinu sent away his father-in-law. He said, okay, you're going home. I acknowledge that, and he sent them away. So it's not clear when did Yisro go home. It is clear that he was there when we left Har Sinai. It is unclear, did he go home right away, or did he go home after some point later, after the spies, after the story with Korach, it's unclear when he went away. But it seems, at least possibly from Rashi, that he did initially go with the Jewish people towards Eretz Yisrael. Why? Because, as I told you, Rashi tells us the Jews did fulfill the words that Moshe Rabbeinu told Yisro, that if you come with us, we will give you land. Well, if Yisro refused and ended up not going with them, then they don't really owe him the land. It was only on condition he comes with them. If he didn't go with them at all, then perhaps they wouldn't have given it his family land. But if he went with them, intending to go to Eretz Yisrael, and then after the miraglim, after the spies, then he went to his land, well then, it's a strong argument. He listened to Moshe Rabbeinu. He did go with the Jewish people, but then the Jewish people derailed it. So he went back home. So then it would make sense that the Jewish people fulfilled Moshe Rabbeinu's promise and gave him land. So again, this is a debatable point exactly when Yisro left, and it could be they gave him land even though he did not agree to go with them at all. Maybe he did go home and still they gave him land. Whatever it is, we know he got land in the end. We know that he did go back to his land. We don't know exactly the chronology of events of when that happened. But Rashi does tell us that he did not go home and come back again to Har Sinai. It is one leaving from Har Sinai that took place, which is described back in Parshas Yisro.
He got the land in Israel?
He did get land in Israel, yes. His children got land in Israel. Okay, what land did he get?
Right.
What land did he get? Well, you'll recall that when we entered Eretz Yisrael under Yehoshua, we came to the first city we came to was Yericho. Yericho was defeated and it was destroyed. And that area was therefore not settled. There was a curse made on anybody who would rebuild the city of Yericho, but there was an area called Dushno Shel Yericho, which means the area around Yericho, which was also not settled by the Jewish people. That land was eventually given to the children of Yisro. The descendants of Yisro were given that area. Now, that is a curiosity and a discussion. What is the connection between Yisro and Yericho? They sound similar, don't they? Yisro, Yericho, right? But clearly there is a connection between the two, because that's why they gave the children of Yisro Yericho. The truth is that the letters are almost exactly the same.
Right.
The letters of Yisro and Yericho, it's just the only difference is a ches and a tuf, and a tuf is very similar to a ches, it's just a little extra thing to it. Right? So they are very similar. That's a discussion of itself. Yeah.
So Leviam did or did not have land?
Leviam had cities with some land around the cities, but not huge portions.
So them being Moshe's children, they're Leviam.
No. You're not Yisro, not Moshe's children. Yisro's children. Not Moshe's
children.
Other
children.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Now.
It's a problem.
Yeah.
Because for some reason we're not supposed to understand what's going on. So there must be something else.
Okay.
What are we supposed to get from this?
Well, you're saying that it's unclear exactly. Okay. Okay.
Right.
Okay. Okay. But there are a lot of things like that in the Torah.
It sounds like Ramban maintains, he said that Yitro went with Moshe and settled near.
Yeah, the Ramban reads the Chumash differently than Rashi. Rashi
right.
is willing to move things around like that. So, right. Yeah.
The word Vayishalach is very strong.
Yeah, Vayishalach.
Vayishalach.
Yeah, he sent away.
That is
a strong statement. Yeah.
Very.
Yeah, but it could be that just means that he told them, you know what, there's no point in coming with us anymore. We're stuck here for the next 38
but
years.
That, he could have said that in another way. That word
yeah,
to say.
I agree with
he
you.
He could have suggested, Hotzia, something like
yeah.
that. That word
yeah.
is very
I agree with you. I agree with you. It is a strong term. I don't have a good answer for you. It is a good question. It is a good question. But I just want to point out to you, just to close the circle on this, that when Moshe Rabbeinu first said that, come with us, and we will do good for you, because Hashem has spoken good about Yisrael, that doing good would have been something different than giving him land. It seems to me that doing good meant we will treat you properly, because we are commanded to treat the gerim properly. Don't think you will be treated as an outcast. You will be treated properly, for Hashem has spoken good about the Jewish people. Hashem has taught us and instructed us about how to behave, and we will treat you according to that goodness. We will treat you as one of us. We will not treat you like a second-class citizen. We will not treat you like an outcast. But he did not offer him land at first. Then when Yisro said, I'm going to go back, then Moshe Rabbeinu said, if you come with us, we will give you land. And in the end, they did give the descendants of Yisro land. Yeah?
I was thinking, I may be maybe wrong, but that Pasuk Lamed Beis where it's mentioned Tov three times.
Yes.
Maybe because he's a ger and he accepted the yoke of Shemayim, that he gets the brachas of Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov like all his children.
Okay, but that would still not be land.
No, not land, but
yeah. You're saying that brachos,
properly,
yeah, yeah.
If he goes to Eretz Israel, he will be treated properly, yeah. Because he's not part of the Am of Israel.
Okay, good. Very good. Very good.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.